VanWee Financial is a registered investment advisor. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy discussed herein. Saturday morning, and we have not been devastated, and we are not underwater, so we are here. How about that? I'm very happy to report that Florida kind of dodged a bullet this past week, because a heck of a lot of people did not dodge that same bullet, and it's done plenty without interfering with us. Anyway, it is, again, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, and that means this is the VanWee Financial Hour. I'm Steve VanWee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And we are here, as always, so that you don't have to spend your entire week listening, or weekend anyway, listening to pre-recorded canned financial radio shows trying to learn something with no possibility of input. So if you want the possibility of some input, you're in the right place at the right time, and all you got to do is pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255-222-TALK. Lines are open, and as most of you know by now, the callers always go to the head of the line. We will have a trivia question, which we're going to do right after the break, because we're still debating which of a few to do. So that won't come out right before the break, as it sometimes does when I don't forget. Let's see. Howard was saying on the real estate show that there were a couple of thumbs up for the market this week. And it was a shortened week, and it started poorly on Tuesday, but the week certainly took a little turn for the better, didn't it?
Much like the hurricane, it did.
It's almost like a relief rally, which is usually applied to something else.
Yeah, it was a good week. It really started off on a sour note, and the reason was a pretty good reason. The ISM Manufacturing Index was supposed to come out with showing small less growth than it has been showing. It's been in a 5-month decline, but instead it showed that the that manufacturing actually shrunk last month. That was not something that the market really cared to see. The reasons for it are pretty clear, in my opinion. China, the trade wars are definitely hurting the manufacturing sector. The index has been in a decline for 5 months. After 35 straight months of expansion, it went into contraction territory. But the internals of the report show that import and export orders are the weakest since 2009. So you have to think that it's really being driven by the trade war talk. And then the reason for the rally this week was actually positive news on the trade war. So hopefully that'll be enough to reverse that.
Yeah, all this stuff was not canceled. It was just delayed until they have more certainty. So when it bounces back, look out.
The major thing to remember about the manufacturing sector of our economy is that it's very small compared to the services sector. In fact, manufacturing drove $2.3 trillion of economic output in 2018, or 11.6% of total economic output. This accounts for 12.75 million jobs, or 8.5% of the labor force. So it's not insignificant, but you look at those numbers, 8.5%, that means that well over 90% of the labor force is employed in things other than manufacturing. And
the other than manufacturing news was pretty stellar.
Getting to that, but yeah, that's true. Right now, even though manufacturing has been shrinking, 89% of manufacturers can't find enough skilled labor to fill all of their open jobs, despite the fact that manufacturing jobs pay 12% more than the average job. And the reason that's given is that there just isn't enough skilled laborers in this country. So when you hear about when kids are making decisions, should I go to college or should I get a skilled and go into the skilled labor force, really might want to think about going into the skilled labor force, because there are good paying jobs in the 80,000s in a lot of cases. And I think a Detroit auto worker union member makes about $58 an hour. So they're really good jobs are available.
Not only that, but the type of jobs you're talking about now, it used to be you go to the car factory and you put clip A on post B a few hundred times a day, and then you leave. not like that anymore. There's a lot more going on in today's vehicles.
Definitely.
And on the production lines where people actually have responsibility, need training, and all that.
And then this is interesting, too. Despite the fact that manufacturing makes up only 11.6% of economic output, America is still the largest manufacturer in the world. We produce 18.2% of the world's goods. China is the second biggest at 17.6%. So I did not know that. I thought China was larger. And
I
it
guessed,
turns out we are.
Yeah, I would have guessed reverse.
Me too. So the services sector, which you mentioned earlier, that's really the one to watch. And that actually posted a very solid beat this month on the ISM report. It was supposed to come in at 54, but it came in at 56.4. And anything over 50 signals expansion. So the much, much larger services sector expanded at a pretty good clip this month. After Tuesday, the market momentum swung in the other direction on the news that the U.S. and China have actually planned trade negotiations for next month. That optimism lasted throughout the week, taking the Dow 1.5% higher, while the NASDAQ and S&P both gained about 1.8%. This positive movement also brought the three indexes back into the black for the quarter, something that looked very much in doubt a few weeks ago. The upward movement of the week was pretty well distributed, with consumer discretionary and energy being the leading sectors with increases of 2.75% and 2.7%. Utilities, which have been pretty solidly overbought recently, were the lowest performing sector at 0.37%. And international markets got in on the rally too, with China gaining almost 5% and the European markets added around 2% each. Over the last year, though, the best performing country is Jamaica, which gained 55%. Captain Dave has mentioned that several times.
Yep.
Pretty impressive. Brazil is second at 34%. The worst performer has been Bermuda, losing 33% of its value. And the second, Pakistan, down 26%.
The second one I understand, Bermuda.
I have no explanation for that. Yeah. The U.S. is right in the middle at 3.6% increase over the last year. Over the week, commodities were mixed, although the most notable move was in the natural gas sector, which has been really volatile lately. It gained over 9% just in the week. Fixed income retreated a bit, with long treasuries declining 84 basis points. This brought them down under 22% gain on the year. If you can make sense of that, good luck.
Yeah.
Outside of the ISM indexes, there was a lot of other economic data as well. Half of it beat expectations, which is better than what we have seen lately. The jobs report was the major focus on Friday, and it was a mixed report. The headline number, which gets all the attention, was an unimpressive 130,000 jobs. However, there were some really bright spots in the data. First, Black and Hispanic unemployment rates hit their lowest levels ever. And the gap between the Black employment rate and the overall rate is also at the lowest level ever.
Yeah, those don't fit the narrative, though. So you didn't hear it.
You don't hear about it much. No. I had to dig to find this stuff.
This was the worst week of reporting for jobs that we've had in almost 2 years.
No doubt about it. And here's another one. The employment rate for women age 25 to 54, so prime employment years, hit its highest level since 2002. Since Trump took office, female employment has increased by 1.8%. And while unemployment growth did slow in August, jobs are still increasing faster than population. So we're more than keeping up with that and absorbing tons of new people into the workforce, as you're seeing with the labor force participation rate, which creeped up again this month.
It jumped a little bit, actually.
Was 400,000 or 500,000, I think.
Yeah, I've got all the other stats. I'm going to give you the real numbers on the jobs report right after the break, because what you hear is just so much bunk, and it tells you, always when you're listening to something, consider the source. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Vanley Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanley Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanley.
And I'm Adam Vanley.
And we're going to dive right in to a trivia question. There, you've probably heard this. That's the one thing the press is willing to discuss a little bit. That's a good thing. The number of women that are in the workforce is rapidly rising. The Great Recession had been actually very hard on women in the workforce, which I'm not getting into the demographics or the maybe whys, wheres, or whatever for that. It's just a fact. But the Great Recovery has been very good to women. How many more women are working today than were working on Inauguration Day? And we'll take it to the nearest 100,000. So you can sort of guess that it's a pretty good sized number.
Yeah. So basically in 2 years, mm-hmm. what has been the net increase in women in the workforce?
Mm-hmm. And anyway, back to some real numbers. On Wednesday, the ADP, which is a private payroll company that statistically samples their private payroll companies to actually get a handle on what hiring or letting go is being done in the strictly private sector, that came out at 195,000. Now, how do you square this one? The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics number, came out at 130,000, and the first thing they pointed out was that 25,000 of those were actually temporary census workers that the government hired, so the real number, in their opinion, would be 105. Well, that's 105 in the establishment survey, and ADP says it's 195. Somebody is not terribly accurate here, which is, you know, they say the sampling's better than that, but I see it a lot. You see it a lot. So let's give it a month or two and see how it plays out. But then the thing you never hear about, the household survey. The household survey usually leads the establishment survey a little bit for the simplest of reasons. When people are out of the workforce and start coming back in, they don't always do it by knocking on the door of the employer and saying, hey, I need a job. And he says, okay, fill out the form, and the next day you're on the payroll as a W-2. What people do now far more often when they reenter the workforce or enter the workforce is they get contracting gigs with companies that are willing to pay them on a 1099 basis as independent contractors, or they just go out and they offer their services to people for fee for service. Well, those people are working, but they're not counted in a W-2 situation as they would be with ADP. Well, this number came out at 590,000. And that number, I have seen other months that big, but I've been following this stuff for 17 years, and I haven't seen it very often, I'll tell you. But now what's happening inside all of that is very interesting to me. The 3.7% unemployment rate did not change. Now, you would expect when all those people started working that the unemployment rate might cut down, but that's not what's happening. There were a couple hundred thousand new people, population growth, but there were something to the tune of 364,000 less people that are not looking for jobs. In other words, all these people came back. They were the frustrated, the tired people who couldn't get a job. Well, guess what? They know that the job market's good enough now that they're coming back in droves. So this report has so much good news in it that you have to be a real, I don't know what, ideologue or whatever?
Pessimist? I don't know.
Yeah, same thing, I think. In other words, the media narrative was not accommodated this month by any other than the employer type BLS report. They wouldn't talk about any of the other ones. How are things out there in the job market? Well, they're so good that the pace of job increases, especially at the lower level now, annualized, the pay rates are growing at more than 4% now, up from 3.2.
And non-managerial wages are growing faster than managerial wages. So
isn't that amazing?
We haven't seen that in a long time.
No, and just another little thing about how are people feeling about all of this. Who were the big winners in the market this week? There was a few of them, but here's two you never hear. Energy and communications.
That's right.
Had a really, really big week. And then the ones that you always hear, like technology, that's fine. That's easy to understand. But the other one is consumer discretionary. You know why consumer discretionary goes up?
Yeah, because the people have more money to spend. They're going to go and blow it on stupid stuff that they don't need.
Oh, ain't that American?
Certainly not going to save it. Come on.
There was so much good news in that report yesterday, and yet if you turn on any of the regular news, you're probably thinking this place is falling apart. In fact, I summarized the headlines for the week a little bit today. It was the headlines are more of a progression than a single event, All over the weekend and the holiday, the gloom and doom crowd was pointing out the R word, recession, recession, slowdown, recession. And it was especially tied to manufacturing when they heard the manufacturing number. Well, that continued into Tuesday, and as Adam said, the market dropped there. But then, all of a sudden, one mention of China, and all of a sudden, two things happen. Well, all of a sudden, we're talking about maybe that perking up the manufacturing and so on. But concurrently, this is so strange to me, the economic data came in brighter. It was almost as if it was waiting for that announcement. So the headlines were reading, oh, market up on renewed market jubilance or whatever. The economic numbers are coming in strong. And then Friday, of course, the jobs report came in at 1:30. New economic fears hit the market today.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have three different opinions in a four-day week. It just doesn't work. Oh, well. Anyway, listen to us and we'll tell you the truth. And how are things? Things are good. Thank you very much. How's that?
Yeah. I mean, the only downside of this week outside of Tuesday was Friday was pretty flat, but it still flat was not bad after the week we had already had.
No, flat was wonderful. I like it. Well, you ready for a shack attack?
I don't know. Am I?
I think you should be.
All right.
Because I got one. By the way, lines are open, 904-222-TALK. It's 222-8255. How many more women are working today than we're working on Inauguration Day? Shaquille O'Neal was recently interviewed by a fella, Lester Knispel. My apologies for the tough name to say. He was actually a business manager at the time. This was reported by the people at Yahoo News. And I really liked it, except I thought it was a little bit inaccurate, and I'll tell you why here. So Shaq was telling this reporter how Lester taught him about money when he first started to make money. He handed him a piece of paper and said, this is a $100 bill. Then he ripped it in half and handed him the half. He said, you save $50 and you can play with the other 50. But the difference between rich and wealthy is you rip the 50 in half, and with the 25 you can do whatever you want, but with that first 25 you save. But what I took issue with was he considered it taxes and savings at 75%, and I just don't think that's right. He was mostly saying you save the other half, not because of taxes. He didn't emphasize that when you make that kind of money, you're going to pay the first half in taxes. And I think that should have been the highlight of the article for people making a lot of money. If you start doing really well, you have to allocate 50% to taxes. If you live in a place like California, New York, you'll do a little better than that in places like Florida. But the point was definitely made. Here's 25% of your money. You save 25, you pay tax with 50, and you can go ahead and do whatever you want. And since Shaq got his first big check, and the things he did with it were, I guess, kind of sudden. I can't blame a guy for this, but bought himself two new Mercedes, bought himself a house, and paid off his mother's mortgage. That was kind of the first day. Must be nice to go from nothing to something, eh?
No doubt. It's kind of like the call we had last week.
Yeah, sort of. But Shaq's point here was that this discussion has stuck with him forever, and he has made over $700 million now, wow. And he is worth an absolute fortune because he didn't get in tax trouble, and he saved 25% of everything he made.
Nice.
And if that isn't a lesson for life, I don't know one. So congratulations to Mr. Shaq. By the way, what do you get if you cut Shaq in half? Two really big guys. Good morning, Marlene.
Oh, we lost her. Well, call back.
Marlene,
if you can.
Call back, please. I probably can't take it because we just lost you real close to the break, but we will take it immediately when we come back. So sorry about that. Anyway, after the break, I've got a little something that I call All the Gold in California. Went where? California's done it again, people, and it just keeps getting worse and worse out there. I cannot believe that these people have, what's the word, the chutzpah, I guess, to do the things they're doing to their business community. And what scares me the most is that somewhere down the line, guess who's going to be paying for it? I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that California's stupidity is going to become the problem of the other 48 states, and it's probably going to happen in my lifetime, and it's definitely going to happen in your lifetime.
Pretty sure there's 49 other states.
What did I say?
48.
I was counting Obama once. I don't count New York as a state. They can't help. Anyway, I'm going to talk about that afterwards. I said that?
Yeah.
Sorry. Is it early today for someone? I'm not sure it might be. But don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Vanway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanway.
And I'm Adam Vanway.
And lines are open, 904-222-TALK, 222-8255. Trivia question is still out there, brought to you as usual by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888, and it's a very easy, not an easy answer, an easy question. How many more women are working today in America than were working on Inauguration Day in January of 17? To the nearest 100,000. Well, when California business and prosperity are finally and forever declared dead, it will be ruled a suicide. The guilty parties will have only themselves to blame, as the California state government and court system will be responsible for the premature death of the California business climate. Now, I grant you, they have a little help from their friends over at the Ninth Circuit Court, which is a federal body, but all they do is accelerate the process a little bit. The single biggest reason California business is still respirating is that the Golden State had so far to fall. It was named the Golden State because it had all the gold and all the wealth and the real estate and the weather and the people and all that going for it. In fact, it was so good that Larry Gatlin wrote that wonderful song called All the Gold in California, which I still love. I think he might be writing a revised version of that soon. But if you remember a term called death by a thousand paper cuts, it's an ancient Chinese method of execution, and that idea has kind of morphed into a slow but eventually deadly progression of individually small wounds, in this case to the California business owners and the business climate in general. Increased homelessness and drug addiction, which are generally related, taxes, regulations, and crime, all those confront California businesses every day, and none of those things seem to be improving at all. People are fleeing California in droves. They're taking their businesses and their gold with them to places like Nevada, Texas, Florida, and so on, that are more user-friendly for people and business. As businesses and wealthy individuals leave, prosperity in California decreases one paper cut at a time. These losses add up, they compound, and eventually this exodus will prove to be financially deadly. Well, all this begs the question, what next? Well, I have that answer, I'm sorry to say. Recently, coming out of the California Senate Appropriations Committee, on a 5-2 vote, the committee approved a new standard for who can be considered an independent contractor versus a W-2 employee. I was just talking about this in the jobs wrap-up a little earlier. All this follows in the wake of a court decision called Dynamex. It was a California Supreme Court decision in 2018 in which delivery drivers were ruled to have been incorrectly classified as independent contractors. Now, if you're wondering why this would be an issue, you just go right down to the bottom line. All the elected do-gooders in California are creating in their minds at least a utopian society in which all companies are successful enough to treat everybody to the very best of wages, benefits, and working conditions. Health insurance, vacations, personal time, holiday pay, family leave, minimum wage, ad infinitum. These are the California requirements for having anyone perform services for your business, no matter how great or small. Some businesses can afford these, many cannot. The 20th century's best economist, in my opinion, shared by many, Milton Friedman, observed that, quote, one of the great mistakes is to judge policies and programs by their intentions rather than their results, end quote. He must have been studying the California legislature at the time, as that seems certainly to be their modus operandi. A few decades ago, California started taking baby steps toward that utopia. Back then, there used to be two political parties, so they had a little push and shove going on. And even California had a series of Republican governors. But slowly, the whole governmental body has evolved into a one-party system. No more push and shove, no more baby steps. Now they dive right in. Faced with insurmountable impediments to success, many businesses simply fold. Some are portable, can be moved and reopened somewhere else. Others are not, and they simply fold. A lot of the people that own them, if you look around, some of them might be your neighbors now here in Florida and other friendly states. According to Forbes magazine, the loss of population and wealth from 2011 to 2016 in California totaled 243,000 ex-Californians, earning a total of $7.7 billion annually. Those people and those earnings are now in other states, like this one. Somehow, today's leaders in California are claiming no harm, no foul, claiming that the state has a budget surplus. That claim is not easy to support, especially when you look at the California balance sheet, which shows a massive debt. And by massive, I mean can never be repaid massive. This debt includes over $1 trillion, note to everyone, that's 12 zeros, just in unfunded pension liabilities. With about 12% of the U.S. population, California owes about 20% of the unfunded pension liabilities in the entire country. The growth is accelerating. They do nothing to curb it. Herb Stein, for those of you who remember him, economist and father of the always entertaining Ben Stein, Bueller, that Ben Stein, once proclaimed that if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Ironically, he lived in Washington, D.C., which has the only debt that is possibly worse than California's. What's the difference? Washington, D.C. has a printing press. California, no printing press. Where does that leave us? At the national level, it leaves us printing fiat money and getting rid of our debt or accommodating our debt, however you want to do it, with inflationary dollars that have no actual backing. Where does it leave California? It leaves California in a position of debt service that cannot be repaid. I mentioned a little earlier. What is going to be left for them? I think we've had some foreshadowing of this in places like Detroit. Technically speaking, I do not think that a Floridian should have to participate in a bailout of a bankrupt Detroit or a bankrupt California. Too bad, people. You did it. You get out of it. You default. Try to restore your credit rating. Try to get people to come back. But you're not going to because you keep doing the same stupid things the same way over and over. You want to see how massive this could be? Remember in 2007, prior to when things really started to go downhill, we had been told for decades that there is absolutely no way that Fannie and Freddie are going to be our problem, the taxpayers. They were set up by Congress to be independent, to make money, and be self-perpetuating. What happened in 08? They basically collapsed. What did Congress do? You know, I've said many times, and you've all heard it, I'm sure, whenever something goes wrong, the people in Congress have this irresistible urge to, quote, do something. Most of the time that they do something, they'd have been better off doing nothing. But they always have this, and it's never, I fear, going to change. What are they going to do this time? They're going to bail out California. Just as sure as I'm sitting here talking to you on a radio, they will bail out California. And as much as I detest that, I don't think I can stop it. And I don't know who can stop it. I don't even hear any of our officials on either side worrying about this. But meanwhile, you hear what good shape California is in. Don't believe it. It is bad and getting worse. So my admonition to anybody who is a Californian is to get out while you can and take your gold with you. Man, I don't know how they think of this stuff, folks. It's absolutely beyond me. Oh, well, anyway, we're going to, Adam's got to talk about market timing a little bit when we come back. I'm just frustrated. I read all this stuff over again this morning. I first read it early in the week. And I shake my head and say, how can it be? And then I listen to Gavin Newsom on TV saying the most inane things. And nobody even asks a question of the man. Wait, you know, if we had a media, we might have a country. If it weren't for Fox, I cannot imagine how bad this country would be in. And I'm not sure that they're strong enough by themselves to do anything about it. All right, well, enough of that. We'll talk about more fun things like investing and timing the market and all that as soon as we get back from the break. The lines are still open. Give us a call, 904-222-TALK, 222-8255. And we will we'll hit on the topic of why you can or cannot time this market. This is the Banway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Banway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Banway.
And I'm Adam Banway.
And this segment brought to you by Robinson Landscaping and Maintenance. Call Troy at 662-9794. And he is right now de-Dorian in our yard, which most of you don't live in such heavily treed neighborhoods. It looked like you didn't have a lot of stuff, but man, our place is a mess. It's no harm, no foul, just a mess we got to clean up. That's all. So I'll take that every day of the week compared to a hit like Irma or Matthew. Those were not pretty sights. Well, you know, Ben Stein says you can time the market. And he wrote a book about it a few years ago. And he said, you time it over long periods of time. You might be out for 6 months or 2.5 years, whatever. And I thought, you know, I think that's kind of oversimplified.
I can prove why that doesn't work.
Well, it also is a retrospective look at the market.
Yeah, it's really easy.
It didn't
easy.
Do anything from here to here, so you should have been out.
It's so easy in hindsight to tell exactly when to buy and sell.
But that's a lot of those market timers from the 80s. Dick Fabian was a noted one who could tell you when to be in and out of the market based on his 52-week moving averages and things like that. And he had one for gold that was a 20-week moving average. And one day I noticed that gold acted incorrectly, and in his next newsletter, that 20 was never mentioned again. It was 52 weeks for gold, too, because it didn't fit the narrative. Now, if you want to get soured on the concept of timing, all you got to do is see somebody backtrack like that and try to cover it up. That's it. So what's the truth?
The same thing happens with if you try and do charting or, you know, the market should act this way. It should bounce off its 50-day moving average, and it does a lot of the time until it doesn't. And then it breaks through and does something different. So
the algobots are going to let it happen or they're not.
Yeah.
And you don't know how they're programmed.
You have no idea. And there's so many of them, even the guys who program them don't know what the other ones are doing. So anyways, so during volatile times like the last few months, it's difficult to maintain resolve as an investor. We know how tempting it is to sell out of equities based on fear that the market will have another 2008 type event. This is especially true in hindsight when you look back and you say to yourself, wow, it really would have been a good idea to get out of the market a month ago and miss out on all these losses. That's a great theory, only it's a month too late. When you invent a time machine and show us how to go back and make that decision at the exact right time, that theory will work out really well. So if you think selling is out at the right time is hard, then try to time the market bottom. In October of 2008, the S&P dropped 27% in the first part of the month. However, by the end of the month, the index had rebounded and ended up down only 14%. Did you jump back in and gain that 13%? Of course you did. But then you immediately sold out again because between the end of that month and March 9th of 2009, the market fell an additional 30%. Of course, it didn't fall in a straight line. There were many other small rallies followed by periods of steep declines. So when would you have jumped back in? By March 23rd of 2009, the market had shot up 23% from its low of 676.53.
And that time it didn't look back.
No, it didn't look back again for, well, it still hasn't.
No.
From there, it continued on the concurrent 10-year bull run despite several other volatile periods along the way. To prove this, we looked at 10 years of S&P 500 market data from 1989 to 1999. We chose this period so we could see what happened 20 years after each day that we looked at. From that period, we selected the 10 days where the market moved up and down by the largest percentage. For this analysis, we assume that $100,000 was invested at the end of each of those trading days. We looked at what your total return would have been 5 years later and then 20 years later. The goal was to prove, hopefully, that not only is market timing impossible, but over a long period of time, it is fairly inconsequential as well. We found that over 5 years, the standard deviation of returns was very large, or 41.39%.
That's no shock.
That's about 6.36% annualized. From that data, you would conclude that market timing not only matters, but it matters a great deal. However, when you look at the returns over 20 years, the annualized standard deviation of returns drops to just 0.48%. Because of the data set we chose, we realized that this was an extreme example. Next week, we're going to run the same analysis using 10 random up days and 10 random down days and see what the results say. So for this one, we looked at the 10 biggest increases and 10 biggest decreases. So I think if we choose random days, that 0.48% might get a lot closer to zero.
Well, in our business, as you know, there's an old saying that says, well, okay, this is the day that we got a new client in, the money's in, we've got the plan made, the client has selected a portfolio. And what day do we buy? And the answer is today. And the reason is, in 5 or 10 years, you're not going to remember what day you entered the market.
Exactly. And this kind of, it does matter over 5 years if you look at the extreme example. So 6.36% annualized is a lot of money. However, in 20 years, 0.48% annualized is not nearly as big of a difference. So I think next week when I run this analysis again, it's really going to look like it doesn't matter at almost at all over 20 years.
But thinking about it, thinking all the people we have, our client range, age range is several decades of age. And when somebody new comes in that's older, we very often will go in over three separate days every 6 weeks, 25% or something like that, because they don't have that 20 or 30 years to have that level out a little bit. So we try to be a little bit judicious. But when the young people come in, we say, you got the money, slam it in the market and let it sit.
Yep.
And 20, 30 years from now, you're not going to remember anything.
It's true. Especially, and that's another thing we do is we don't buy individual stocks very often. Right. And the reason is when you buy an individual stock, you always know what you paid for it. But tell me what you paid for SPY the last time you bought it. Yeah, you have no idea.
Nobody can remember. No. It takes the emotion out of the sell process and the buy process, frankly, when you're using ETFs. So we're big supporters of that. Cool. Well, I'll be curious to hear next week. All right. You know how I like to pick on stupidity? Boy, do I love to pick on stupidity. This is a Think Advisor article. They're interviewing a Social Security authority named William Rickenstein. He has a way to fix the broken system, and he's happy to share it with you. His way is 180 degrees from the reforms proposed by prominent politicians who mainly want to tax the wealthy and pay those funds to low-income people. He is exactly right about that part. So they asked him about several different proposals, Chris Christie, John Larson, Bernie Sanders, and so on. And his response to all of them, that it was unfair to the wealthy because all they're really doing is transferring money from the higher to the lower. Now, some of those proposals are pretty simple. Like right now, there's an earnings cap, which is something to the tune of $130,000 this year, plus or minus a little bit, after which time you don't pay into the system anymore. You pay into Medicare, but you don't pay into Social Security. And that, of course, is a very serious wealth transfer. One of the other main proposals is they stop, as they do now, withholding Social Security at about $130,000. But at $400,000 a year, it picks up again and goes forever. Which, by the way, is coming.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
But it again, it's a huge punishment to the wealthy because the benefits don't go up anymore. The guy goes through a whole bunch, and he says things like it's adding almost pure 100% income redistribution features. He's exactly right. So I'm reading through this thing. I get two pages deep. I'm really excited about this. This guy must know something that I've never thought about. So get over here, and it says, let's see, what is the focus of your plan? See, I'd like to reduce those income redistribution features using a two-tier system. Okay, well, what's that two-tier system? Well, raise taxes to make the 12.4% payroll tax of the first 132.9 of income higher. Wait a minute. That's your answer? Raise taxes on everybody? You can't fix anything by raising taxes. There's not enough money in all the income of the people that are in the lower part to fix it. He says that you put 2.4% of the payroll tax into the insurance portion and the remaining 10 would go to the retirement income component. It isn't perfect, but it'd be a whole lot better than raising the income limit.
Wait, why? It's the same thing.
No explanation, no follow-up question, no nothing. This is absolutely ludicrous. And that is why I love to pick on stupidity. Made my day. All right, well, it's up again. It happens so fast, it seems. Thank everybody for listening. We'll be here again next week. And the answer is 1.1 million women now. And if you think about it, that number is very interesting because it doesn't factor in all the retirements and such. This is just additional women. They all the ones that retired are replaced, and 1.1 million more are going to work. Thank you, Donald Trump. We'll see you next week. This is the Ben Lee Financial Hour.